can film in it.
Andy Farrington, here, overlook, one of the most beautiful places. The townsland is
Ballynockin,
and we're in the parish of
Valleymount,
and
that's the parish church over there in the middle.
Okay, and we have Dublin to our backs, haven't we? County Dublin, and we're in County Wicklow.
We would be maybe to our right, back that over way beyond Manorhill Bride, I'd say.
Yes.
That way, we go down through Blessington and on that way. You would have, that's right.
And Carlow then would be on the
Carlow would be directly on our left.
Yes,
over there.
To the west, to the east side,
the
actually,
east.
Yes.
Dublin would be north from here.
Yeah.
Kind of north.
But the lake, just look at the lake, and that's a man-made lake.
That's a man-made. That was flooded the year I was born. I was born in 1939. And I was brought home as a baby along the old road. And shortly after that, it was flooded. So I never remember seeing, this without a lake.
It was a marshy bog, wasn't it?
There was a bog in the middle, but there was some good land as well.
Yeah.
Now, my ancestors, my grandfather had a lake. The way it was in Ballynockin, a lot of the people, my family is in Ballynockin. I'm the fourth generation. And we have a headstone in Baltibyes, was put up in 1857. So my family is here, and I would be the fourth generation. I would be the fourth generation of stonecutters in that family. My great grandfather was a stonecutter, and my grandfather and my father was a stonecutter. Now, they did own bits. Some of the stonecutters owned a bits of land. My grandfather owned a little bit of land, about 9 acres in all, and he lost 2 acres in that lake. Plus what you call his turbary rights, that was cutting of turf, etc., which was very important to the people at that time. There was terrific bogs down there. But lucky enough, his residence was that one down there, and of course the flooding didn't come in here, and he remained on in the place, as did several more. But a lot of families had to, all of their land was taken, and of their houses, and they bought properties in County Kildare, etc.
Yeah.
And without it.
And the two quarries that we have, one was Lacken Quarry.
We had as much as 9 quarries.
Was there 9?
In Ballynockin.
Yeah.
Back in, they're recorded in 1840, around 45, that in the world, recorded that time. Who owned them? And I remember myself, and I going to school, we had Osborne and Brady, which was the main quarry, the big...
We go out this way, yeah. Yes.
Osborne Brady was the big quarry. That was the largest quarry. That was a company. Brady lived in there, in Lurdle Lodge, and Osborne lived down in what is now the Ballynockin Inn. Two very big houses. And they amalgamated and went together. And they ran the quarry as Brady, Osborne and Brady. That was that one. Then beside that, we had DJ McElroy, a famous quarry. The quarry, Granite House, is still there. Of course, it's closed too. Over here, right behind me, we had Patrick O'Brien, which I remember working in that. And now I'm talking about now 1950 and along that time. Finished up around that. Freeman, James Freeman, on the right again. Back over the other way. Then there was another one that I didn't see him working called Johnny O'Brien on the far side. Then over the other side, we had W.J. and C. McAvoy, another quarry, and that's where John and David are still working. They're not quarrying, but they're still in that premises. Mm-hmm. Their place was established around 1846. And then you had Patrick McAvoy in another little quarry. So you had all of those. And they were recorded. Ballynockin was put up for sale one time, the whole of Ballynockin. It was put up for, you know, that time landlords owned it, and it was bought by the Waterworths. The Marquis of Waterworths. And they bought it. And this, I seen this list. I actually had the list of the quarries that was going. And there was a rental on the quarries to the landlord. About £40 at the time of the big quarry, and 10 and 20 and so on. And even at all stages, the landlord retained the mining rights. They always retained the mining rights. You never could own your own unless that they sold it to you. And that's what actually happened in latter years. Some of them bought them. A man in coming up to 1958-59, things went very bad and most of them were closing down. And the Osborne Brady one, Mr. Osborne, the last Mr. Osborne had died. Mr. Brady had died in 57. And the two widows decided to sell that big quarry. There was a man called, it was the Creedon Group, Con Creedon. And he had some stone cutters from Ballynockan working for him inside in Dublin, and they told him about this quarry. And he was finding it hard to get Wicklow granite. Came out and he looked at the quarries. He looked at the other ones, that was Freeman's, O'Brien's. They were vacant as well. And of course, the Marquess of Waterford was the real owner then. So he went and he did a deal, bought Freeman's, O'Brien's, Osborne's and Brady's. Bought the lot around 1960. And moved in. Now I went to work for him. I went to work. Creedon was quite good for giving employment. I went to work for him not until the late 70s, and I was with him till the year 2000. Now it closed down completely in 2001.
So, and would you remain the last of the old stone cutters before the machines?
I'll explain that to you in detail. I started to the stone cutting in 1955. I did a little bit with my father. I officially started with a firm called, I forgot to mention them, Foster Brothers. That's where I started.
That was another
quarry.
Yeah.
And if you could remember the 50s, things were going very, very bad in Ireland, and concrete was coming in and stone was going out. But my father always wanted me to follow the trade, and as it turned out, I was an only child, and I was very interested in it, because as a toddler, I was looking at my father doing bits of work, and he used to do bits of work at home, because he was a man that had a lot of problems with arthritis, and he'd be off work, and he'd do a little bit at home. And actually, he finished off work as a very young man in the early 50s. He had worked in a place called H&J Martin's in Grand Canal Street, and they were doing the first big Portland stone job that came into Ireland, that's Bussaras.
Oh, did they now? Yes.
H&J Martin did that.
And the stone came from here?
No, Portland stone. That
sorry.
Was.
And the Portland stone came from there, yes. Yeah. And that's what that was.
That was done. That was the first of them.
But did that take did that upset?
Well, it did. That kind of thing did. But of course, the Grandstone remained very prominent, and I'll explain that to you, because as I said, in if we come up along the line, I went to the trade with Foster Brothers, and I was very lucky. They were into the monumental business as well as the building business. So with the buildings going bad, headstones were always going good, and I served my time with them. Now, I mean, for to actually go, and there was another boy who served his time, but he left it quite soon after, went to something else. Other young men that had started in, I'm talking about people that started in 1950 before me, 5 years before me, and 51 and 52. I was the very, myself and one or two more were the very last to be trained in the old style. Mm-hmm. We were trained how to take a piece of raw stone that came out of the quarry, with no cut of a machine on, no face on it whatsoever. And we were showed how to get the first flat face on that stone.
Mm-hmm.
And that was done, they were showing us how to punch a straight line along the edge of the stone. It was done by putting a straight piece of timber on and showing that it was straight across the end. And then that edge was placed on the end, that piece of timber. And you had to, some people call it, I suppose, take the stone out, twist. You had to, they showed you how to stoop down, sight the edge, and set in the fourth corner. And leveled off the whole face. That was the skill.
Yeah.
And then, of course, from there on, you worked the square to get a square. And then if a design came up, the design was placed on the face and it was penciled round, and you learned to go to the design. But the thing about it was, for the first year of stone cutting, we were showed how to get this stone from raw into a square piece.
Yeah.
How to do the basics. And you wouldn't be allowed to do any of this fancy stuff or moulded stuff until you advanced.
How long did it take you to become?
It took me the best part of 5 years.
From an apprentice to
and
qualified.
I tell you now, I started, and as I started officially, I did a little bit with my father while I was waiting to get. I was lucky to get the apprenticeship. I got the apprenticeship in early 57. And as I said, there was emigration was even starting at that time, and they wanted a couple of young lads. And the position was this. At that time, I nor nobody else could become a stonecutter unless that your father was a stonecutter and a member of the trade union. So permission had to be given to Mr. Foster to start me to work.
Because
it was a closed shop. It was a closed shop up to 1960.
Yeah.
A closed shop. Very strictly closed shop. And the simple was that the stonecutters in County Dublin and Wicklow, Ballynock, protected themselves that way. They made sure their own families got priority. And I think it was wrong, because a poor chap that if his father wasn't a stonecutter, he couldn't go to the trade.
So
and it was very limited. And I'll tell you how it was limited. An employer, a quarry employer, could only employ one apprentice for every three full-time men, fully trained men. Mm-hmm. They were called journeymen. That's the name now in the stonework. A journeyman stonecutter is a man that has finished his time and he can journey anywhere he likes. I think that's where the term come from. And work all over the country. But it was strictly a trade union. A meeting was held. It used to be meetings held in Ballynock. A meeting was held in Ballynockan. So, you see, what happened, the quarry owner, they couldn't start an apprentice unless he had three full-time men. So the union would know this man has 10 full-time, he's 10 stonecutters, he can start three young lads. Now, Foster was lucky enough, he had six and he was able to start two of us. And he did start two of us. And that's exactly the way, that all changed, as I said, when it came up towards the 60s, when, thank God it did change, that other boys. Because I remember a school pal of mine, I never forget it, a school pal of mine, and his name was Tommy Kelly. And his uncle was a stonecutter, but his father wasn't. And he asked, could he go to the trade? And there was a union meeting held. No, he wasn't allowed to go. The fellow went off and joined the army. Now, he was a pal of mine.
Yes.
Because my father was a stonecutter,
yeah.
I got in. Well, that's the way it was, and there was nothing. If there had been, we'll say, a lot more men working, you know what I mean? They could only take on one for every three.
Yeah.
And I think the reason for that was we were trained on the job. You weren't sent to college, you were trained on the job. And you were put between two fully qualified men. We're all worked on benches. I'd be in the middle, a full time man here, another one there. And the reason for that was so that the employer was making sure that the men training us didn't waste too much time with us, and yet they had to. One, the man on this side would spend maybe a half an hour with me, showing me how to do this, and I would do a bit, and then the other man would show me a bit. They had to keep their own production up, as well as train us. That was the idea. The employers were tough, you see, because they wouldn't, there was no such thing as, but we were trained to perfection.
Yeah.
There was no half measures taken. It had to be done right. Of course, I had a great interest in it. And if you didn't have an interest in it, you wouldn't do it.
But you have to have a feeling for
Well, I had a feeling. Actually, it was in the blood. It was in my blood.
Well, I know you're retired, but you haven't left
I
the job. You can't keep
up.
Away from it. Yeah.
This was given to me. And it was a pleasure to... I said to Kathleen, I said, I will do this fine finished stuff for you. That is... There's a slab of stone came out of McAvoy's.
No, this is a job for a local woman that you were telling me about.
That's right.
That she came and she said that
she wanted
her husband.
Her husband.
Now,
because
he loved the stone.
This is going to be a Celtic cross.
Yeah.
And this is the old finish. Do you see this finish there? That is the finish. That's a sawed finish.
Describe that finish.
That is the punched finish. Done with these hand tools. I only sharpened them the other day in the forge. I sharpened my own tools. I'll chip a bit and show you there, if you want to hear the noise of it. I'll just put the glasses on. You'll see what I'm doing. One tap now. I'll just watch your face now. You'll hear the tap of the hammer. It's tedious work. You see the chips flying. See the dust flying.
Now, can I just stop you there a second and ask you, there are two things about that. What you are doing is you're dressing the stone.
I'm dressing the stone.
Yeah.
I'm giving it a punch finish.
Yes.
Now, if you look at this here, I have drawn out with my compass the circle. This is the band, the circle. That is a Celtic cross.
Yeah.
And these are the bands here. That's the shaft, that's the top. And normally, I will be cutting that in there and cutting it in there with that. Normally in here, you would have those light holes. I'll show you some photographs of them inside. But this one is a replica of St. Kevin's Cross in Glendalough. John Sullivan loved Glendalough as well as here. And this is only 3 foot long, because where it's going in this, we're confined to a total height of 42 inches. So what we're doing is we're making a replica of St. Kevin's Cross.
Now, tell me about the stone itself.
That stone?
Yes. Now, what quarry did this come out of?
That came out of McAvoy's quarry up there, John and David's.
All right. Now, it's speckled granite.
That, I'll tell you the right title to that one. It is. That is what you call the oatmeal brown texture. We have a bluish one in Ballynochan and an oatmeal brown, and that is the real one. That is, it's a nice one. And if you would be familiar, I'd say, with Seamus Murphy, that the famous sculptor in Cork. He wrote a great book on stone, and he referred to the Ballynochan oatmeal brown stone as being the most the stone cutters all over Ireland were more fond of that than any of the stone. The County Dublin stone is a great stone, but a very tough stone. Very harder on the, you know, to cut and that kind of thing.
And how can you step aside the blue light?
Well,
yeah. How do you compare the stone with Carlow granite?
Carlow granite is a softer stone, but a very good granite. It's very close to it in colour. There's no question about it.
And when the sunlight hits it, you can see it sparkle.
Exactly. You look it over there without it sparkling.
Yeah.
You'll see it sparkling. See there? See there, look?
Yeah, yes, indeed, yeah.
And you see, you have spell. It's made up of quartz, feldspar and mica. That's the composition of granite. And this is the mica now that's shining up there.
Yeah. But like that again, you know, for somebody like you who said you're passionate about this and it has to be.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that you have to have a feel for the stone.
You must have. And I said in a quote one time to somebody, you see, it's as simple as this. You cannot rush making stone. You've got to have the time. You've got to, because if you try to rush it, you can't bully stone. Stone is tough and it must be cut the right way. And you have to know exactly what you're doing. And you must have the feel for the stone. There's no question about that. If you didn't like the job, you wouldn't stop at it. I did love it. I loved the job and I had a deep interest in it.
And patience you'd have.
And patience. Yeah. Now, when I started working, as I said, I started officially, took on by the permission from the union, and I went in to work in the quarry. And at that time, it was a 44-hour week. You worked until 12:30 on a Saturday. Now, that's 1957. And the starting pay for an apprentice was £1.08, which was about 2 and 6 taken out of it for social welfare. So you came home with about 25 and sixpence. And that, you know, £1.05 and 6. Now, it looks nothing now. But you worked at the trade for 6 months. Then you got 10 shillings of a rise. And eventually you got another pound of a rise until you got to the fourth year, and then you got up to the full money, 40 or 50. So you were a long time. You see, you wouldn't even stay at, because my pals, they were all going over to England at the time, emigrating, and they were coming back with lovely suits of clothes on them and everything else. They were saying, oh God, the money we have over there. You know, that kind of thing. And here was I struggling at this trade. But I said, I think the fact that I was an only child and parents didn't want me to leave the place. And we had a few acres of land, 7 or 8 acres of land. But I loved the thing. I stayed at it. And lo and behold, at the end of the day, it paid off. Because I was happy what I was doing. I never had to emigrate. I've earned my living up to the year 2000. at this work.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And enjoyed it. And my good friends who are still in England, some of them, and come home, some of them come home, and they've turned around and said to me after, you know, you were the lucky one, not us. You had the healthy living in the country.
Yeah, you've just the workplace is lovely.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's true. You see, at that time, and I don't want to wander away on this now, at that time, you see, all my relations now, cousins, they were full-time stonecutters and that sort of thing. The Osbournes, there was, my auntie was Mrs. Osborne, and there was seven sons in it, and about five of them were stonecutters. And the five of them emigrated to Liverpool, and a lot more Ballynockan men, the Coes, some of the McAvoys, the whole lot. They went there, and they know the reason they went there. The famous Liverpool Cathedral was in being finished. There was a number of years' work on it. And one man on that, from this, had been on it for 30 years. It was going on that length, a man called George Flynn.
He worked on it for...
up to 30 years, because it was on and off with the war and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
They all went over to work there.
Yeah.
Them fellas went all over and worked on the Liverpool Cathedral. Some of them went into stone yards over there, then more of them branched away into factories, and the other men all came back, retired and came back here.
Yeah.
But a lot of the younger men stayed over there. Sorry.
We'll walk down this way because that brings me to, you know, all the you told me a lot of people had to leave this area
because they did.
But what about, and the same, would the same apply to the quarries when they started to close down? You know, did families uproot and off?
That's right. Most of the quarry owners, you see, were older people and retired. The owners retired and lived and died out here in their own place. But definitely, the village suffered a dreadful drain. It was wicked in the 50s now. A terrible drain. And you had a lot of vacant houses all around here. Stonecutters. See, the stonecutters lived in the village in different little houses around. And they emigrated. Some of their families came back after and redone the houses and that kind of thing. But it was a terrible, it was known, I suppose, in Ireland as the Hungry 50s, really, in different parts of the country. But it hit us very, very bad here. And that was the worst time that we ever were hit. But it's restarted again. The trade came back again, as I said, when the Creedon Group took over in the 60s. And we had we never had a huge crowd working. We had about 17 working. Between sawmen, stonecutters, there was four stonecutters that were trained in the old style. Now, the three of them were older than me. I was the youngest of them. And we worked with, Mr. Creedon got a huge amount of different building work all around the country. And the final ones that we were doing, some of them famous and not so famous, were the civic offices in Wood Quay.
Yeah.
They were done, every one of them, all of that civic office, the first phase, you know, the Sam Stevenson one. And that was very controversial because you didn't have any craft work on that. You had slab after slab of stone hung on the wall and it looked like a cardboard box. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That to me is not stonework at all. But what I loved was anywhere that we got, we'll say, the restoration of Dublin Castle or the Bank of Ireland, we sent a lot of stuff into that. And one thing I did enjoy then was a few years before I finished up, the Army GHU in, what would that be called, Brewery, is it? I think it is.
Yes.
It is. I worked a few columns for that up there. And that's the sort of thing I did. Actually, I have a photograph inside of a few pieces. We enjoy doing that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's, you see, this is what I love doing, because in Dublin, with the erosion of stone, maybe over the years, I believe what happened was a lot of softer stone went into all of the buildings. And over time, they eroded and had to replace them. You know,
I know there's a helicopter overhead. But
if you take the Bank of Ireland.
Yes.
The Flynns, like when I was only working, that Flynn man, George, Jim, Christy Coe, Brady's, all a lot of them from Ballynockan. Rebuilt, along with the County Dublin men, rebuilt all of the ashlar along the Bank of Ireland there in Dame Street. You know that building?
Yes.
And that stone was every stone in it was supplied by the quarry in Ballynaughton.
No, all that had to be carted from here in there.
Oh, yes.
And I just, you know, when you listen to the helicopter overhead there, transport was something far more difficult in the early days.
Well, I'll tell you now, I know all about it because a friend of mine, and indeed I have a photograph of him somewhere, we had what they call the stone draymen. These were the men who had horses and carts. The bigger company of Osborne and Brady had about 9 horses and 9 carts of their own for transporting their own stone to the buildings of Dublin. Now, this is where Ballynaughton created a great lot of employment. A lot of people around got the contract of cart and stone, would supply their own horse and cart. And now the interesting thing about it, the cart that you would see drawn out turf wasn't the same. It was the same, the cart for the stone had to be a stronger body because they'd be bringing a ton weight of stone. And they had an extra 2 or 3 spokes in the wheels. Now, of all this from a man that did this, and they had, in the middle of the cart, they had a stronger centre board. And what happened was, the men going to Dublin were loaded in the quarries up here at 6 o'clock in the evening. Is that how I knew that? What happened was, the system of carting the stone was the horse and dray, as I said. The men with the horses and cart arrived into the quarry at 6 o'clock in the evening. The windowsills, the window lentils, so many cornerstones, kines for the buildings, whatever it might be, was placed on the carts. The men set out for Dublin. They went to the embankment below. And there was a place there, now I have the name of it inside, and they rested there. There was a place for drinking the horses. The horses drank the water. They maybe had a sandwich or whatever. And they continued on their journey till they got to the city centre. And they were there in the morning in time for the men coming in on the buildings. Mm-hmm. And the men coming in on the buildings unloaded the carts. And the carters went to what they used to call an eating house, to be a restaurant. And they got the breakfast. And the breakfast, one man, Eddie Cullen, explained all this to me because I had many, many a chat with him.
Eddie Cullen.
Neddy died.
Was he a farrier?
He was a stone carter.
A farrier. Yeah.
A lovely man. And he told me that the breakfast they got was a tremendous breakfast. There was porridge, there was rashers, eggs, etc. And it was 9 pence. They had a pound for the journey to bring the load to Dublin. But they made a few bob on the side, because what they did was, some of them, they went to the markets and they collected goods, such as, we'll say, for the shops, bags of flour, etc. and all that sort of thing.
They did the shopping for the local people?
For the shops.
Oh, for the shops?
Not for the people.
Yeah.
The shops would say, I want so many bags of stuff from the market or whatever it was.
All right, and they used to
And they brought that back to Blessington to the shops and to Ballymount to the shops. Yeah. And of course, I had a few extra bob for that.
Why not? Make as much use of the journey.
But I mean, they were marvellous men.
How long did it take?
To get to Dublin?
Yeah.
Well, they were good to go all night to where.
It was a night trip. Started.
It was night, always at night.
Yeah.
Because you see, the men in the quarry had them loaded at 6. And they started off then, yeah. And they went all night. And another very interesting thing that he told me, because I wrote it down, I said, I have a good bit of that. He said, you must appreciate, he said, that in the winter they got it tough, because the roads would be slippy, yeah, with the load. And there was blacksmiths, certain places with blacksmiths, and you used to have to stop at the blacksmith. And sometimes you would have to do something with the horse's shoes, maybe re-cock the shoes and that kind of thing. And another thing which stuck in my mind, and I never really, he says to me, he was a very intelligent man, he said to me, a lot of people think that there are no hills in Dublin. But he said, there are hills in Dublin, because I know by going up and down them with the horse and cart. And he said, the Gardaí, or as he called them, the Polish men, he called them, they said they were so kind to the horse and dray men.
Why did he call them the Polish?
I don't know, I suppose it's from the old English time.
Yeah.
If the carters were coming up a hill, now there are places in Dublin there, you'd know them yourself. I can't think of it. Below Dame Street or down there, there's a bit, and I know there's a few hills. He explained the places. But when the carter would be coming up the hill with the horse, if it was slippy, if he had to stop the horse, he'd find it very hard to get going. And the Gardaí always stopped the traffic and brought the horsemen up the hill. He gave them priority over everybody else. And I think that was a lovely gesture.
That's most interesting.
Yes.
What was this man's name that...
Neddy Cullen.
Neddy Cullen.
Neddy Cullen. The man is dead now. He's dead a long time. He's buried in Baltibais. I actually put his name, put a little memorial over him. A little book with his name on it.
What else did he tell you about the work he was doing? And because they
were the real men.
They played a very important part in the whole thing. Sure.
Well, you see, he would be one of the last carters, because he told me he finished about 1930. The lorries came in. The main quarry, the Osborne and Brady, bought a lorry of their own, an old Leyland or something. And then other quarry owners hired lorries, and the horse and cartman went out. But there was a huge lot, there was a team of men, carters, bringing the stone. It couldn't be done any for them. You know what I mean? That was a great little supplement to this man coming in here, I think.
But it was extraordinary how crafted these people were too.
Absolutely.
And did you have local coopers then?
Oh, absolutely.
Did he talk about coopers, that made the tools, that made...
Well, I had the experience of the blacksmiths myself. There was coopers that made them all right.
Oh, look, we'll sit on this lovely stone here.
That's another of my... Would it be cold for you?
No, not at all.
But, the blacks, he did talk about them. There was local coopers, and they made the wheels, and they made these rays. There was a man called Mr. Farrell from Tour, lived over that direction, and he was an expert at making these wheels for and then the blacksmiths, you had around, and you still have them around in a few places. You had what there's one up the road I could show it to you, a shoeing stone. This was a stone made about the size of a wheel, with a hole in the centre. And that was outside the forge, in the quarry. And the blacksmith, the iron band, he beat out the iron band, he shaped it, put it together, and brought it out, a couple of men with him. And the wheel was put sitting down on the shoeing stone, with the box part of it, the middle band, that was down in it. And he put down the band over the wooden wheel, and it slightly burned its way down. It was tapped down on it, and it was dead tight on it.
And you mentioned that they put more spokes into the
wheel.
They
did. There was an additional spoke in it, two or three additional spokes in the carters. And the shafts were a little longer in the heel.
Yeah.
So that they could heel up. Heal up that way and get the stone out of them easier.
Were they using local wood?
I'm quite certain they would. Yeah. I'm sure they would have done that, because there were local tradesmen that was making the carts.
Yeah.
And of course, they were all dead before my time, my father even knew about it. He knew about that. But that's everything, you see, that was the one spin-off thing about the quarries. And even in my time, when I started trade, there was two full-time blacksmiths in the big quarry. And there was one where I was working in Foster Brothers. And the reason for that was, and I'll show you the tools there. We were working with the old types of tools. There were steel. And the steel, I'll give you a history of the steel. The steel was Jackson steel, which come from a company in England. And it was called Jackson's. And they supplied bars of steel. I'll show you the steel. Bars of steel to the employers. Now, the quarrymen, I should say. Now, when the stonecutter wanted some tools made, he went to the quarryman and he said, I want so many tools made, the quarry owner. Perhaps he had to pay a little fee, I don't know. But the order was given to the blacksmith, and he cut the bars across and he made what I have there, so many punches. He needed about a dozen of the punches. He needed about a dozen of what we call bolsters. That's 2-inch chisels. He needed a dozen of half-inch chisels, etc. And the blacksmiths made them. And in what happens with a stonecutter, one of them punches that I have there, and I can show them to you, was this was all handwork. When you were punching that stone, as I'm doing there now, the point on that punch became blunt within a half hour. So therefore you needed so many. And what happened was, the batch, your batch of tool, you sent in half of your tools with an apprentice, with a nipper, they call them, into the blacksmiths. And the blacksmith had, we'll say there could be 50 stone men in the big quarry or more. He had these batches of tools all along. And a very important thing was that each stone cutter, including myself, I had my names, you had your initials indented into the chisels, so that they didn't get mixed up with anybody else's. The simple was, if I sent in a dozen tools to be sharpened, they were all placed along, the apprentice left them, or nipper left them along, the blacksmith did out so many tools, and they were put on this tempered stone. They were heated in the fire, the point beaten out on them, and then they were dipped in the water, and it to temper. Now, I can temper tools myself. Can I temper you? Them? Oh, yes, I can. And because I was showed how to do it. I had to learn.
Yes.
And the temper going down, you're watching the colours going down. Now, the top of this is red hot, and you're watching this going down. And there's a straw colour appears coming down. And just at the end of the punch, which would be less than an eighth of an inch, you see it at that point, you just dip it in the water. And that stops it running out of it. That's holding the temper. Then you stand it up in a little tray against the wall with that depth of water in it, let it cool.
Well, now, isn't that something?
And that's the tempering of the punches.
Yeah.
Now, I learned how to do it. Normally, some stone cutters never had to learn it, but because it was always someone. But my father said to me, it would be very, very beneficial to you to learn how to sharpen your own tools.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was. And the reason he said that was, a lot of the men that went to work in various places, there wasn't a resident blacksmith in it. And only for they knew how to sharpen their own tools. It was always a forge. In any stone place, there was always a forge. Now, I have an anvil of my own, and I have the little fan bellows.
Now, could you tell me, the iron itself, you know, when you were banging the stone, you could hear the ring
yeah,
of the iron.
That's right.
And you know, you will get blacksmiths that will tell you that that the anvil is either good quality or bad quality.
Of course they will. They will.
Are you able to tell the difference in the quality of
the anvil? No, I wouldn't be able to tell the difference. I bought this anvil when I finished in the quarry in 2000. I could go in there and sharpen a few tools hand in, but when the quarry closed down, of course, nobody was in. And I said to myself, now, what am I going to do? And I inquired from 2 or 3 retired blacksmiths, and they had 2 or 3 anvils. And for sentimental reasons, they wouldn't sell an anvil.
I know, they just, it was part and parcel,
but I'll tell you
of their work. Yeah.
In Athy, County Kildare, there was a market on Sundays, and I believe there was everything to be sold in it. And I was talking to a man, and he said, I was in that market, he says, on a Sunday, and I actually saw an anvil for sale. Mother God, I says, I'm going to go down there next Sunday. I went down the following Sunday. And he told me the man, he was a man by the name of Stokes, and he actually came from Limerick, and he had all old things, pulley block changed, you know, the old things. And I went to him, I said, you happen to have an anvil? He said, I had one here last week.
Yeah.
But I didn't sell it. I said, I'm interested in it, provided I can afford to buy it. Tell you what, he says, it's going to cost you £300, but it's a very good quality. If you're interested, I'll bring it here next Sunday, and you can come down. Well, I said, I couldn't afford to give it £300. I said, I'm a retired stonecutter, and I want to do a little bit, but I said, we'll talk. So anyhow, I went down on the Sunday, cut a long story short, and I got it for £250, as it turned out.
Yeah, I know.
And lo and behold,
were they pounds or euros?
Oh, pounds at that time. Yes, I'm talking about 2000, the year 2000.
Oh,
now.
Yes.
That
yes,
time,
yes.
The year 2000. And that's how I have the anvil.
Yeah, isn't that? Well, listening to all the trucks and the sound around us is coming from road repairs,
yes,
here.
Yes, we've had a new pipeline put in here.
Yeah.
For wanted it for years. A new water mains.
But what was the road system like here over the
road,
years?
In my early days, there was no such thing as a tarred road. It was all rough pebble, kind of, that kind of thing. And that road down along there now was all made by the quarrymen. It was sand out of the quarry and that kind of thing. And I tell you what I do remember, and it's only disappeared some of it in recent times. That road down along there was always a channel on this side of it. And they had lintels of stone all the way down by the side of the road. And the bottom of the channel was paved with
was
stone.
It, yeah.
It was. They put a new pipeline in, that's all gone. But there's a little bit below at the very end,
yeah,
just at the end of the house where I did live. And it was a unique piece of...
So that was the road made by the quarrymen.
Yeah, that, you know,
one. Down around
it
there.
It was a council, yeah, road, but the stone came from... Yeah. I remember seeing myself. I remember seeing the stone being drawn out of the quarry and men with little sledgehammers breaking up the stone and making...
Oh, yes, indeed. They
do.
They did, yeah.
They did. And a lot of it came out up there now.
And that wasn't easy to work.
That's
on.
True. And I'll tell you another thing, that another very interesting thing. You see, in Ballynockan, you had very good spells of stonework and very bad spells. And one of the spells that was bad was in, it was coming, where was around, just before the 50s. No, it was the war years now, which I don't remember, just the end of it, I was young. But what happened, my father told me, and I seen the last of it being done. The county council started widening the roads from Ballymount to Ballynockan. And on, if you're driving out there, on the left-hand side going out, if you look at our wall below, that stone wall, they built all of them walls from them quarries. And a lot of the stone cutters went to work on the walls, building the stone walls. You know, there was times when the quarries weren't going good. You didn't have full employment the whole time. And there was always something, an alternative came up.
So they went out and worked with the
council workers? They
went out and
worked. Building, they did. But they did the building of the. They could handle the stone. They could hit it with a sledgehammer and shape it. They turned themselves into stone masons building. They
says,
did.
Yeah.
And you can see their skill in it, actually.
Yeah. And that road now will take you from where to where?
This is Ring Road. If you came that way, I think, through Lacken. Right around the lake, down through Ballymount, back to Blessington. If you look over there, Ballymount is a peninsula. In the middle there, the church and the school is there. And you go over a big bridge to get out of it.
Yeah.
You go over a big bridge to get from this side.
And tell me about those bridges. Were those bridges...
Them bridges were done by a big company in the 1938-39. They were done the time of the Pool of Focus scheme, when that place was flooded. Them bridges were put in. And there was old stone bridges, I believe, down there, which I never seen. They had to be... They were so good, so well built, I had to get the army to blow them up. They couldn't get them down.
Now, we spoke about the nine quarries here, and
that's right.
And all closed down now.
That's
and,
right.
And
that's right.
Gave lots of local employment here in that.
It did.
And kept people going.
But I'll tell you something now. The most interesting thing about Ballynockan, and I seen it here, was the main quarries took a huge contract. I mean, what they did was they built bridges, they built churches, they built government buildings all over Dublin. Now, the main quarry might take on a huge building, a church, for example, stone church. And he would set out portions of that to all the smaller quarries. And he'd know about they're doing that because all of the quarries had the same texture of stone. So if a bit was done in this quarry here and another piece done over there, when they were put together, they looked the same. And you see, they shared the work, which was a brilliant thing. And another thing that kept the stonecutters going here was, and my father said that, in times when they'd be let go maybe for 5 or 6 months until another job would come in, they got quite a good bit of work from farmers. Little bits on the side they'd be doing, for example, a fireplace for a farmer, a chimney stack, on the farm, a gate pierce, stone roller for rolling the corn.
There were many
pig trucks.
Yes.
For feeding the pigs.
That's right.
And they did all them. The stonecutters here did all that. And they always said that it was great that they always got that bit to do. You know, you didn't have, like, a job would come into the quarry and it could last 3 years. And then all of a sudden, there'd be nothing for a while. But they had to find alternatives. But they got that kind of stuff. Now, the headstone business was a great business here because the Foster brothers and the number of the McAvoy's too, they supplied all of the big yards in Dublin and in Bray. Millers of Bray, huge big stone place. McAvoy supplied them. Robbins brothers, Mount Jerome. When I went to Foster's, I did all sorts of headstones for Mount Jerome and Robbins and all them sort of things. I learned that trade, and I also learned the cutting of the letters. I can cut, you know, cutting letters. To this day, I get a few bob out of cutting letters, and I'll tell you why. People come up to me and they say, you see, nowadays you have your machines for sandblasting. You know, it's done out with paper. You're probably seeing, I don't know if you were looking at the television, last Nevin, it was a bit on. And you're seeing where everything is done now with computer. Paper goes on the headstone, and this machine blasts it on. But I was learning in the old style, where you drew out the letter and you cut them with your little chisels. And there's still a little bit of that going on. And it even happens here. When you're going back that way, if you go that way, Aidan will show you. Some people come to me and they say, would you do a name of my house for me? I've put a big rock up in the garden.
Yes.
I done one only before Christmas over there, and it's called Granite's Drum. An Englishman. Granite's, I don't know why he had granite. Granite was something, but drum was some abode he had in. I've done several of them.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. They come to me and ask me, would you do that in the old style?
And yeah, because you can see there's a big subtle difference, isn't it?
Total,
you know?
Difference. Yes. And I'll tell you what, yes. The sandblaster one goes straight in. The ones that I would cut are V'd in.
Yeah.
V'd from both sides.
Yeah.
And you'll see a straight line in the middle, and you'll get these little surfs, they call them. Little tails on them, that's it. You'll get in with a little chisel.
Now, tell me something. How could you define a stonemason to me? Is he as enthusiastic as you are? Is he a man that is...
A stonemason is a man... We call ourselves stonecutters, and we're defined in the trade union as a stonecutter. We are the people who... We don't call ourselves sculptors. We'd be close enough to a certain degree. We would be maybe called maybe monumental sculptors. But we wouldn't be making statues or that kind of thing. That's a different grade. I would be kind of a monumental sculptor. I could do anything with Celtic cross, interlacing, etc. A stonemason... I define a stonemason as a man who will build these most beautiful walls out of any sort of stone. That's a stonemason. A stonecutter is a man who takes a piece of stone, dresses it, and makes something out of it. And that's how I define them.
Right, that's the difference there.
That's the difference.
Yeah.
There is a difference. You have very, very good stonemasons who specialise in building stone, dry stone walls, if you know what I mean. You see them all over the country today. You have a lot of chance or two that's not doing it right either, whatever.
But just looking at some of your work before we you've got a lovely little...
That's a bird bat.
Bird bat.
That's a bird bat.
And how long did it take you to make that?
I tell you now, there's 4 days work on that.
Imagine, 4 days.
There is.
So there's no mass production in this work?
Oh, no. Yeah. Not. And I have some other ones. That piece of stone there under the table, if you look at that.
Yes.
That... The reason I made that block under it, that was a piece of block out of our own land here. And I wanted to... Ballynock and Salt.
Yeah, it's all stone.
Oh, yeah. I'll show you now. Let me show you now. I'll just show you here now. This is my ground here. If you look at that wall there, do you see the lintels standing up?
I do.
We call them scantlins. That's an Irish name. They're posts. They're stone posts. And all of those were cut out of this land by my grandfather and granduncles. Because in times of slackness in the quarry, they come out to the fields and they strip the big rock and they cut those with the old picks and punches and got their horse and slid them over to the wall and put them in it. And if you look close at that, do you see the holes in them?
I do.
A piece of wood was tapped into that and a staple stapled in the
wire. What was the purpose of doing that?
To tie the wire in.
Oh, so that the wire would then run through it.
Pass by it. It's passing by it.
And wrapped around it.
That's right.
And that's the way it was.
The way it was. And if you look, if you look now, I'll show you from here. You see the whole row of them down along.
Yeah.
They were all taken out with this land.
And what because they were doing two things. So
they were cleaning
the land, and they were making a very nice
fences. They were. There's no doubt about it. And they got little contracts too. Stonecutters got little contracts, as I said, from farmers to do the stone roller or do maybe a pier. You know, if you go around the country, you will see some very nice hand-punched piers with gates swinging out of them, punched on all sides with a little point on the top. They were all kind of private work that stonecutters got and done, you know what I mean?
So much of what I see here today is all kind of man-made by the local...
Oh, absolutely.
Local lads.
Oh, absolutely.
The houses.
That's true.
The stone houses.
That's right. The little stone houses, the lot.
Yep.
Chimney stacks, the whole blooming lot.
The roadway, as
that's
you
right.
said. The canal, the channel going
that
down
channel,
the side.
And that channel, I was sad to see it go, but it's gone. That's time, you see. The road is narrow and pipes went in and pipelines, etc., you know.
Yeah.
Some of the men, when they were taking them, oh God, they didn't dump them. They brought them off with them to build something at home. You know what I mean? But at the end of the road, that's just the very end. And just as you go out at that little house, the last little bit wasn't covered up. That to me was unique now, that kind of thing. I was interested always in these little things. Because back here now in 1996, We started what we call a heritage weekend. Now it wound up the year before last. We used to, in McAvoy's little quarry up there, we used to light the forge fire and we'd have a bit of stone there and we showed people how things were being done and that. And the lad said to me, look it, you, we'll do anything, but we won't talk. We'll let you do the talk. And I started off unconsciously talking and doing bits. And it sort of come natural to me, you know. And this is why they kept me at the bloody...
So the Farringtons here for how many generations?
Oh, four generations. I'm the fourth generation here.
And your father was Andy as well?
My father was Matthew. My grandfather was Andrew. And my great-grandfather was Edward.
Okay, so it just...
And he lived the longest of any. He was 96 when he died. And he died in 1902. My great-granny died in 1886. And she was only 60. My father died at 61. And I had a quadruple bypass at the age of 61. So only for modern medicine, I wouldn't be talking to you.
My God. But... Thank God.
And I'm as fit as a fiddle.
Yeah, I can see that. You are indeed, yeah.
I set dance, I walk.
Yeah.
I do everything to keep myself fit.
Well, Aidan, it was a very well worthwhile trip coming out here today.
I'm glad to hear that.
Thank you very much.
And you're coming in now and you're going to have a cup of tea with
us. I will indeed.
And what's your name again?
Is Morris.
Morris, yeah. And if you ever want to chat to me again... We probably didn't get half of it. I have a lot of things that I intend doing. I have a good little bits and pieces put together, kind of, you know. And I like to have, I like the history and I like that kind of thing, you know. I love it.